And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. And our next film is in the documentary premiere category. And we're here with the film Bending the Arc and director Pedro Kaas and Dr. Agnes, we're going to get this name right here, Bina Gwaho,
exactly.
the former health minister of Rwanda, and we'll find out how she relates to the film here. But first, we're told this is a film about a group of health advocates who took on the mission of global health equity. So what is that?
Well, I think, you know, this film is really about friendship and the revolutionary idea that healthcare is a human right, that all people actually deserve to have the access to healthcare.
Worldwide,
mm-hmm. You know, it's really about leveling the playing field. It's really about, because someone who's born here in Park City has a certain access to, you can go to the hospital. People, not everyone around the world, over 400 million people around the world do not have access to basic medical health care.
Mm-hmm. And that's how it's linked to global health equity. Because it's global, it's a right of each human being on earth. And it's equity because there is no, you cannot exclude one out of that benefit. So global health equity have some principle. You go for the poorest, for the most vulnerable, and with quality. It's not because they are poor and vulnerable that you give second-hand services. Mm-hmm. You have to bring quality, respect with humility. So those are...
Mm-hmm. I think respect is a huge one in there.
Yeah.
I have seen the film, and I was saying before we went on the air, I saw it the day of the inauguration, and I have to say it renewed my faith in humanity. And I got choked up through the second half of it. I'm kind of getting choked up now because it was so, it wasn't sentimental or, you know, or sad. It just gives you hope that there are people out there who are doing these kinds of things. So that said, what I want to do is briefly tell our listeners what it's about. And I'm oversimplifying because it's more than this. But basically, back in the early 80s, three young medical students who became doctors go to Haiti, and they fall in love with it, and they decide this we need medical care here. We need a hospital. They have no money. They have nothing. They have their altruistic values and a stethoscope, and that's it. And yet they are able, through their connections back home, they went to Harvard Medical School, to get some people on board, their friend Tom White, who had money, to help them invest slowly but surely into getting the things they wanted. And then they were able to go to Africa, do similar things there. And I don't want to give away the big aha moment involving the World Health Bank, but that blew me away too, that they were able to go all the way to the World Health Bank. The World Bank. And pretty much infiltrate, for lack of a better word there. So how did you get involved with this? I mean, these people are amazing, and they literally, when I watched that movie, at least for that day, that changed my life. I went to bed feeling so good.
Yes, and, you know, this epic story, which starts off in a very intimate way, has been very epic in the making a long time. You know, our incredible producer, writer, Corey Stern, read an article. She was working in Nigeria as in healthcare, trying to bring AIDS medications to patients who lacked it in Nigeria back, you know, in the early 2000s. And she read an article about access to healthcare by Dr. Paul Farmer, mm-hmm. one of our protagonists. And eventually she also read Tracy Kidder's book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, which tells a story about Paul Farmer and the formation of Partners in Health. And from there, she really pursued the rights to tell their story. And brought on an incredible filmmaker, Keith Davison, to start making the film. And through, they started filming. They were actually been 7 years filming this film.
You can tell. The footage is amazing.
And they started actually just right after the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. And back then, the film actually was going to be more of a verite follow-along story. So many things happened, and they found an incredible story in Rwanda at that point in time, mm-hmm. which became the Academy Award-nominated film, mm-hmm. Open Heart, which Keith directed and Corey produced. And so they did that film with incredible support from our funders. And then when that was done, and after the success and impact of that, and Dr. Agnes can speak to the incredible collaborations that they've done on that film as well, they set out again to tell this incredible epic story that spans over 30 years, mm-hmm. almost 35 years. And that's when they turned, Keith and Corey approached me to come on board because it also involved a lot of archive and this is my directorial debut, and I came on board. I was an editor edited many documentaries, including actually a few that it premiered here at Park City, mm-hmm. The Crash Reel, Wasteland, and The Square. And then I came on. I come from a family of doctors. I was so moved and inspired by their stories that I came on, and we started filming these incredible interviews with Dr. Agnes and Dr. Paul Farmer and mm-hmm. Jim Kim and get that going. And it also started a very big dig for material that even predates us. We have archival material that spans decades mm-hmm. from also other incredible filmmakers.
Now, did you always have the aspiration that you were going to jump to the director's chair sometime, but then for this topic you decided that this is the time to do it?
I thought, yes, I've always had, actually I went to university for theater directing, but I started editing and I was always loved the process of editing and especially with documentaries, how film really come together in the edit process. But this was a perfect, because this is the perfect project for me. It spoke to me on a very personal level with the values and with the stories that about overcoming huge obstacles, insurmountable obstacles, in a very human and intimate way, and I think it's that have epic global repercussions.
Oh, the repercussions are phenomenal. They go on not just around the world presently, but going forward in time. You know, it changes things. It's a game changer what they're doing. I want to talk a little bit about you, Dr. Agnes. Your character, I love you. I mean, this woman.
Is, I love to be loved. And yeah, I love you too.
Yeah, you are such a wonderful, I don't want to say character because you're a real person, but you have character. And I want to ask you, I mean, you come off with some very, you're a very strong woman. You have to be in this film. What is it like to be a woman of in your position? Minister or director of health, right?
Minister of health. At that time. Yeah.
At that time, in a very patriarchal society, where you were, you are the woman in charge, and at the time of Ebola, and a lot of very serious things going on, not just in your country but in the world, and a lot of it fell on your shoulders. I want to hear a little bit about, you know, how are you able to clear your mind to go to bed at night?
Very easily. First of all, I never think of me about as being a woman. I'm thinking I'm somebody that have a duty. Mm-hmm. So this has no sex. And I'm there to make sure that the most vulnerable doesn't escape benefits. And it's my duty to bring that to them, because unfortunately, vulnerability goes with lack of education and information about your rights. Mm-hmm. Hmm? So being a woman or not, I don't care.
You don't, but what about the people who come up against you who do? How do you handle that?
If a man or a woman come against this vision, like Corey say, I smash potatoes.
I smash potatoes. I like that. I like
so being a woman also it's an advantage because sometimes people who doesn't analyze the situation believe that you are weak mm-hmm. and vulnerable and you take opportunity of that. But if you see in the global health fight now with all those ideas pushed forward by people like Paul Farmer, Jim Kim, mm-hmm. and so many out there, I think that being a woman is being a sister, a mother.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yes. So you bring another dimension. Mm-hmm. Less testosterone and more estrogen, more love and more organization.
More compassion.
And more compassion. Mm-hmm. But that's why it's important, such festival. It's my first festival ever. But having you pushing the information out there across the world will give more hope to mm-hmm. people, will tell them that there is a movement out there. Just join it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Bending the Arc gets its first showing tomorrow, Monday at noon at the Library Center Theater. And we're told that, Dr. Agnes, you haven't actually seen yourself in the film yet. So, but you've gotten your first review.
You come off really well.
Thank you.
Next up, it'll be Wednesday at the Yarrow Theater, and then Sunday, a week from today, down in the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. So, Director Pedro Caz and Dr. Agnes, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for spreading the word of hope, rights, and equity. Mm-hmm.
There's no place quite like Park City, and that's why we support local morning news with KPCW. All Seasons Resort Lodging provides nightly rental management and HOA services to care for your Park City property, as well as marketing and property maintenance. More information at allseasonsresortlodging.com.
Hi, this is Josh Kordecki with Alpenglow Solar and Electric, proud sponsor of KPCW and The Local View with Randy Barton. Alpenglow offers solar energy solutions and LED lighting upgrades. From research to design, Alpenglow offers a complete installation process with full monitoring for all solar electric systems. Information at alpenglowsolar.com.
Okay, and we're back with the Sundance Reel, and we have some guests from a film that is in the short program, the documentary shorts program. It's called Rabbit Hunt, and we have director Petrit Bresnan and two of his compatriots from the film. So, Patrick, introduce us to tell us a little about the film and introduce us to the two folks that are with you.
Sure. So next to me is Kivas Burgess, who is one of the subjects of the film. He's a 13-year-old young man from Pahokee, Florida. And then next to Kivas is my wife and producer, editor, co-director on most projects, Yvette Lucas.
Hi.
the film is well tell us basically what you know
sure.
what you're conveying in just
sure.
a 10 minute film, which is about actually rabbit hunting.
Yes, so the film is observational, and it's about a family going rabbit hunting in the Florida Everglades on a Saturday, and the family lives in a small town called Pahokee, Florida, and there really aren't too many employment opportunities for teens, and so the main character, Chris, is 17, and the way he saves money and earns money for prom is to rabbit hunt. And so the film basically follows the whole family going out into the sugarcane fields and hunting rabbits.
And Kivas, I mean, these are real people. So Kivas, you're not Chris, right?
No.
No. Okay. And you're involved in this how?
I'm a member of the rabbit hunt, and I'm part of this because I'm part of the family, and we go rabbit hunting almost every Saturday when we get a chance to. Or we go when there's a burn or a cut.
And when you say burn or a cut, you're talking about the cane fields.
The cane fields.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens is it spooks the rabbits out.
It scares the rabbits out of the fields. And as they come out, we try to catch them, or we'll send them back into the camp so that we'll get another opportunity to try to catch them.
So basically, the family works as a team. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of waiting involved because sometimes you'll see a fire in the distance and you'll drive toward the fire and the burn will have already happened and the rabbits will have already come out. So when we find a fire, because we had to shoot the film probably about five times to get like the exact kind of perfect conditions to make a one-day film. But Chris, the main hunter, will use his family members as kind of helpers to either chase the rabbits back in, or maybe what Kivas will do is be on the other side of the cane, and if a rabbit comes out his side, he'll chase it back in, and Chris will be waiting for it on the other side. So it's very strategic.
So when did you make the film, and how many days worth of filming actually, you know, were involved in doing this in a short film?
So to start out, it was a lot of photography, so spending time in the fields with the kids, getting them comfortable with us there. There's a whole variety of farmers that farm sugarcane in that region, so U.S. Sugar is a sugarcane company that will arrest kids for hunting rabbits and going on their fields, so no one knows where they're going to be cutting on a daily basis, so we'd see a burn and we'd drive to it, and maybe it was a U.S. sugar field, so we couldn't shoot there, or maybe we would go to a cane field and there'd be 50 other kids there hunting, so it wasn't like a great condition to record a film. So we probably spent a month, and we actually shot the film right before we came to Sundance last year. Mm-hmm. So
now, so you've been following this family and this culture and for a while and documenting it, have you not?
Yes.
So are you aspiring to do a full feature at some point on this subject and these people, or is it, how's that editing out?
Well, yes, we're co-directing the feature. Mm-hmm. So we have moved to Pahokee, Florida, and we've been living there for 6 months now. We are making a feature about senior year of high school. So we started in August and halfway through. And we'll be there until graduation, and so.
Okay, so I have to ask, what you've uprooted your life, you've devoted your life now to telling this story. You've moved to where the story is. What got you involved in it, and what compels you to keep moving forward to get this story out to the world?
Well, as we evolve as filmmakers and artists, the project started as a photography project. My family moved to West Palm Beach, and that's where this island of Palm Beach is, where you have Donald Trump, Rush Limbaugh, the Koch brothers. So the project started out, I was photographing people on Palm Beach Island at their houses, coming out of church, playing croquet, driving Bentleys, and then I would go to Belleglade, and I'd kind of, because it was encapsulated in this Palm Beach County, it was this fascinating divide between the haves and the have-nots. And one day, while I was photographing in Pahokee, I stumbled into prom, and there was just the most fascinating, beautiful goddess in a front yard in a sequin dress in front of what we'd call a project, and her boyfriend was there with her and had a Porsche, and so it was this kind of magical event. And So as we started like seeing lives and sharing photography, we really wanted to evolve into filmmaking because we could really explore so many more topics and show conversations. And
I also think that these are stories that are not in the mainstream. This is a very rural community. It's half African-American and half Hispanic. And stories of young people in these communities are not usually out there. And so we feel like we really want to bring this to the forefront and have people know about their America. Like, there's just all these corners of this country that get... That people don't know about and get ignored. So we're really committed to this community and their stories.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about having a camera around all the time and photographing everything you do on certain days?
I feel kind of shy sometimes, but most of the times when they're around, I feel comfortable because they makes it feel like they're not there.
So sometimes you can actually forget that they're, mm-hmm. you just do what you're supposed to be doing at that moment, what you would normally do, and forget that they're even there.
You stay on a normal basis.
How did you feel when they told you, hey, remember that film you helped us with for a month, and it's going to a festival, and we'd like you to come with us to a place where it snows a lot?
I was kind of surprised because actually it's my first time seeing snow, mm-hmm. and that we got into that and a chance that I got to come to a film festival, I was surprised at the moment.
What do you think of snow?
I like it. It's it's pretty.
It's cold, isn't it?
We're wrapping up here, but thanks very much for The Rabbit Hunt, director Pentret Bresnan, writer and editor Yvette Lucas, and one of the subjects Tevis Burgess, and that film is documentary shorts. You've had one showing on Friday at the Red Stone. Your next time is this Monday at the Yarrow, and your final showing is again at the Yarrow on Thursday at 9 p.m. So, and thank you guys very much for turning out on a Sunday morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. And this is KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming is funded in part by Woodbury Jewelers. Local designs created, manufactured on Main Street. WoodburyJewelers.com. Summit Injury Law, Park City's personal injury law firm. SummitInjuryLawyers.com. Gorgoza Park, lift, serve, tubing, mini snowmobile rides, and more. GorgozaPark.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Officials in Georgia say 11 people have been killed in severe weather strikes. Another 23 are injured. LEU has more from member station WABE in Atlanta.
State officials said the deaths happened in South Georgia, in Cook, Brooks, and Berrien counties near the Georgia-Florida border. Parts of Georgia were under a tornado warning overnight, but officials couldn't offer additional details on whether or not tornadoes were the cause of deaths. Severe weather moved through the South over the weekend. In Mississippi, 4 people died from a tornado Saturday. State officials in Georgia say they're coordinating with local authorities to assess damage and prepare for ongoing severe weather. The National Weather Service in Jacksonville issued a tornado warning for counties in southeast Georgia and north Florida. For NPR News, I'm Ellie Yu in Atlanta.
Southern California is being slammed by heavy downpours again, the third storm system to hit in the past 2 weeks, and the National Weather Service says it's the biggest. From Los Angeles, Danielle Carson reports forecasters say some areas could get as much as 6 inches of rain.
There are flash flood warnings across Southern California. Evacuation orders have been issued for certain communities in Santa Barbara and Orange counties, where wildfires have burned acres of hillsides, destroying ground vegetation. Meteorologist Todd Hall says when that soil gets soaked and there's nothing to hold it in place, mudslides and debris flows become a danger.
Water flows more rapidly. So it's kind of a combination of water, mud, and typically rocks that are in these debris flows that come down off these mountains. And it's not just rocks, it's sometimes big boulders.
Forecasters say the storm could hit the mountains with at least 2 feet of snow and wind gusts up to 60 miles an hour. Down at the beaches, the waves could reach 10 feet today. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Carson in Los Angeles.
President Trump today tweeted that he watched yesterday's protests and asks why participants didn't vote. He also calls peaceful protests a hallmark of our democracy. Hundreds of thousands turned out in Washington, D.C. and several other cities denouncing Trump's campaign rhetoric and behavior. White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus says the news media is working to undermine the Trump presidency.
There's an obsession by the media to delegitimize this president. And we are not going to sit around and let it happen. We are going to fight back tooth and nail every day.
Priebus speaking on Fox News Sunday, a day after President Trump used his appearance at the CIA to accuse the media of incorrectly reporting that the crowd size at his inaugural ceremony was smaller than it was for President Obama. There are no official crowd counts, but photos of the National Mall show the gathering Friday was smaller than it was 4 years ago. This is NPR News. Rescue crews in Italy are still hoping to find survivors from a hotel buried in an avalanche more than 3 days ago. They say there are air pockets they haven't yet reached and need equipment to help them penetrate the ruins. But they also say they're hearing no signs of life from the 24 people still missing. The White House says British Prime Minister Theresa May will meet with President Trump Friday, his first official meeting with a foreign leader as president. From London, NPR's Frank Langfitt reports May plans to discuss free trade and NATO.
As May prepares to guide the UK out of the European Union, she's hoping a free trade deal with the world's largest economy will provide an economic boost. But she's also expressed differences with Trump over his critical views of NATO, which has ensured peace in Europe for decades. Trump has called NATO obsolete. In an interview with the Financial Times, May said she was sure Trump, quote, recognized the importance and significance of NATO. Trump has also said he doesn't care about the future of the European Union. Even though the UK is leaving the European Union, May says it remains, quote, important for security reasons. With the threats we face, it's not the time for less cooperation. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, London.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says new regulations require health insurers in New York to cover medically necessary abortions and most forms of contraception at no cost. He says the move is meant to safeguard protections currently part of the Affordable Care Act that may be repealed by President Trump and the Republican-led Congress. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include PBS, presenting the documentary Alzheimer's, Every Minute Counts, addressing the social and economic consequences of Alzheimer's disease in America, Wednesday, January 25th at 10, 9 Central on PBS.
The Sundance Reel is brought to you in part by Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of Cool Science Radio. Have you been told you need a total knee or shoulder joint replacement? Information about alternatives is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Deer Valley's The Grocery Cafe is pleased to support KPCW. We offer breakfast, lunch, early supper, grocery items, retail gifts, as well as takeaway and frozen entrees. Wine and cocktails are available. Open daily, year-round in the Deer Valley Plaza building, 615-2400 or deervalley.com.
faded down. And welcome again to the second hour of the Sundance Reel with my co-host Stacy Domalski, and we're talking about a film out of the special events, which is kind of delving into episodes from a series on television networks, and this is. We're looking at the film Abstract from a documentary series, and we have the director Morgan Neville and Christoph, I'm sorry,
Neiman.
Christoph Neiman. Mm-hmm. And it's the series here. Well, what is the series called Abstract, or is this particular episode called Abstract?
Well, it's all an abstraction. So the quick pitch is it's a Netflix series, 8-episode first season, called Abstract, The Art of Design. And every episode is essentially a documentary about a different designer who's doing amazing work. And that by design, we look at everything from auto design, stage design, architecture, art, interior design, and, like my subject here, Christoph, illustration and graphic design. And he's the subject of one of the episodes that's screening here at Sundance.
Okay, so I read your bio, Christoph, and you are, talk about a jack of all trades. So tell us a little bit about what makes you tick and why. First of all, include your art, which are many forms. I don't want to speak for you, but I couldn't think of a better subject to highlight on a series like this. So tell us a little bit about you and your art and why we want to watch you.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having us. So I love to draw. I've always loved to draw. And there's one thing that's great about drawing, which is, you know, the act of drawing itself. But even more, like, the real fun starts is when you show the drawing to somebody. And when we look at a funny cartoon, at an illustration in a book, it does something. There are only abstract marks on paper, but all of a sudden we see a knight and a dragon, or we see an idea. So basically there's things unlocked in our brain. So it's a language, like words that unlock certain meaning. Visual language does the same. And this is what I do. When you see a cartoon of, you know, somebody kind of like falling in a manhole cover, usually it's just like a black little square and a stick figure. But for us, it creates a story that's in our mind. And this is my work. This is what I do. And in an ideal world, a drawing looks like it was made in a minute. And for the viewer, it looks effortless. And mm-hmm. what we do in a series is basically say, like, to make something look like it was done in 30 seconds, there's a lot of thought, time, difficulties, often frustration that go into that. But that also is a very integral part of design.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just say, because Christoph is too humble to brag, but he's done so much incredible work. I mean, not only dozens of New Yorker covers, but children's apps and books for kids and adults, and posters and massive amounts of illustrations for magazines and publications. And suddenly when you see his work, you keep going, oh, that.
You don't know him, but you've seen him.
Absolutely.
You're like that character actor that's been in everything, but nobody can
exactly.
say who he is.
Exactly.
Yeah, I when I was stalking you on the internet, I recognized your work. It is. I couldn't remember where I saw it. I do recognize your New Yorker covers.
Yeah.
So I want to know how you found him to have this relationship here.
Well, it was through my other executive producer, Scott Dadich. And Scott has been for the past number of years the editor of Wired magazine, mm-hmm. and Wired. And Scott has hired Christoph to do any number of pieces, and they're friends and collaborators. And so when the series was coming together and we were looking at all of the people, Scott said, we have to do Christoph. And I love that idea. And being the executive producer and a director, I got my pick of subjects of what I wanted to do. And I said, I absolutely want to do Christoph's episode.
I see why.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. When I was reading about what you do and some quotes from you and things like that, it reminded me of this. So a drop of water, like on this table, would just be a drop of water. But when you put it together, it can be a waterfall. It can be the ocean. It can be a rainstorm. It can be all these things. So when you create, what kind of vision do you have in your head? Because your drawings are very unique. So what kind of vision do you have in your head first? Do you see the whole big picture, or are you starting from a drop of water and then see where it leads?
Now, usually I start with the big picture. And this is something we talk a lot about in the series, this idea of simplicity, because a lot of modern design is simple. But it's not simple because one doesn't like ornament. It's more the idea of trying to find the very essence of an idea. So it's almost like you create with a gigantic plant and then you just start cutting off branches until at the very end you have like one little twig, but that one twig represents the very idea of this big plant. And this is the long process, though, so that as a viewer, you go there like half a second and go, bing, and I got it. And this is...
Yeah, it just looks like a twig.
So it's like it's an editing process that goes from, basically you go from 0 to 1,000 and then you kind of slowly count back down to 1. And then at the end, it looks like, oh, was just like this one little thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm a writer. And so once in a while, I'll wake up in the middle of the night with some concept or a brain, some idea for something, and I'll jot it down. And maybe it'll become something else, or maybe it'll die and never see the light of day. But how are you inspired? Where do you see things, and how do you see things? Are you awakened in the middle of the night with an idea for something, and then...
Of course, constantly. I wake up in the middle of the night, I have this amazing idea, I write it down, next morning I look at it and I'm like, what was that?
Yeah,
it makes no sense whatsoever. I find that the best things really come in the process. And our episode really is also, it's also an art piece, and we could not have planned this. Mm-hmm. So basically you have to go with people you trust and then start a journey. And at the end, it's something that makes sense where you think, there's a good reason why we did it the way we did it. But if you try to have a master plan, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, just Christoph also sees the world a little bit differently, and that's great to be able to see it through his eyes. And just yesterday, he was very excited to show me a cell phone picture he had taken because he went for an hour-long walk through the snow here in Park City and was excited to show me a picture he'd found because he'd seen a banana peel on the side of the road in the snow. And
it's a beautiful mix, like Park City landscape, mountains in the back, highway on the left, and then there's like a banana peel, which out of a cartoon in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
It was
exactly.
Just
and even funnier, bananas aren't indigenous here. So.
That kind of reminds me of, if you have a chance during the festival, in terms of kind of of a visual, go to a movie at the Eccles Theater and go up to the balcony. And it's the interesting thing that happens is when the movie is ending, the credits are still rolling and it's dark, but there are dozens of iPhones glowing to life in the audience below, and it's like a cityscape suddenly appearing at dusk.
It is. It's a very surreal and interesting vision to see all of that. Yeah, it is. It's strange.
It's the modern version of holding up the lighter.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm going to ask you a question now that I think all writers and filmmakers here we'll be able to relate to. So have you ever done some of a piece of art, either on commission or somebody buys it for something, and then you find out what they want to do with it or how they want to change it or edit it, and you go, wait, what? So has anybody ever taken one of your drawings and tried to realize it in a way that was counterintuitive to what you had originally envisioned for it?
Well, there were some instances like that, but usually you find that out in the process very early if there's a complete disconnect with people. And the way I work, there's usually like sketches and you talk about the concept. And once I'm done with my drawings, they're usually so intricate that they're hard to kind of use in a different concept.
Oh, good. So you kind of like make it to be what it has to be.
No, but even though often what I do are simple drawings, there's a lot, I think the communication that goes into creating art is extremely important. And I guess most writers, creative people know that this trust between the creative and the people you work with, finding a common language to even talk about, to vocalize what you're doing, this is an extremely important skill. Something I talk with students a lot. They're just like, I just want to draw. I don't want to talk. So you have to be a lawyer for your art in the best sense.
I love that term, a lawyer for your art. You have to advocate for your art.
Yeah. Well, that ties in. Morgan, in terms of this episode, Christoph is very impassioned and articulate about what he does. And so you've struck gold there. But in some of these, are there instances where you know you can find a wonderful designer or artist, but in terms of asking them how they came up with something, say, you know, how did you get the vision for this? And they're going,
Well, Christoph, as you can tell, is amazingly good at articulating these thoughts. And I think part of what I enjoyed so much as a filmmaker was in the discussion of what his process is, which is about abstraction and simplicity and getting to the essential truth of something, that the film itself is a debate often with me and Christoph in the documentary, talking about how do you get to the essential truth of a person and their art? Is it how much of their life do you need to show to represent that? And it was a tug back and forth between the two of us. But I think it's an interesting debate that we actually had about filmmaking and art at the same time.
Was there any point where you went, no, Morgan, that's a little too far?
Yeah, I don't want to give away too much, but we actually took that like moment of discontent of what I kind of refused to do, and that became part of the storyline.
Say, I'm drawing the line right here. Well, everybody has their limits.
Exactly.
And I should say that Christoph is an amazing subject. The show, we have so many different directors and so many great designers, and it goes in so many different directions. So, you know, Christoph's episode, we filmed largely in Berlin, and it's funny, but we've interviewed auto designers and
I read about that.
Interior designers and stage and set designers. And I'm just really excited about this because nobody's ever really done any large scale series about design at all.
Well, let's go to the biz side of that then for a second. How did you get Netflix to go, hey, Netflix, I have an idea. We're just going to, you know, interview interior designers and draw people who draw, and I can't picture Netflix going, hey, that is a great idea.
Well, you know, I was lucky because Netflix came to me and said, we want to do a show about design.
Oh, well, there you go.
Would you do? But really, I have to give credit to Scott Dadich, our EP, who's both a designer and an editor, who really has been trying to talk about design in an important way. He's first with Wired by Design conferences and then with his series and Radical Media, who became our other partner. So I think a lot of people realize there's a moment for us to be looking at who designs the world we live in.
Well, the Abstract, the Art of Design, which is part of the docu-series showcase. Well, you had your debut last night.
We did.
And
the whole world can see it February 10th, I should say,
all right.
On Netflix.
And, so Part City, kind of, we've had our chance, and your next showing is Wednesday, 6 p.m. at the Salt Lake City Library Theater, and you're co-billed with another series. So your partner in this is the called Hot Girls Wanted, Turned
yes.
On.
It's another Netflix series, so I guess art and porn are going together.
Yeah. So. America's favorites.
Yes.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for coming in, you guys.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Mark Miller Subaru is a proud supporter of KPCW. Mark Miller Subaru offers a variety of new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subaru wagons, sedans, and SUVs for transporting your family, your dog, and snowboards, skis, and sleds through the snow. Love the experience at Mark Miller Subaru. More information at markmillersubaru.com.
We're back with Sundance Reel on Sunday morning with my co-host Stacy Domalski and the director Alexandra Philippe. And this is a film that both Stacy and I have really looking forward to talking about this, and everybody, every film person who's even heard of it is looking forward to it, or if they've seen it, they've raved about it. But the film is called 7852. It's about the film Psycho, and I have trouble retaining the title because I call it 1776 or, or 4862 or somebody's phone number, but it's 78/52, no pun intended. What is the meaning of that title?
Yeah, it's a bit of a cryptic title, isn't it? It actually refers to the 78 setups from the shower scene. And ultimately, there were 52 cuts
of
in the shower scene.
Of this film, Psycho.
Correct. Mm-hmm. The film, really, 1752, is very specifically about the shower scene. So, the title really is in homage to that.
Mm-hmm. When I was assigned this and I read the program notes, and I have seen the film, but before I saw the film, I thought, okay, 90-plus minutes on 52 seconds of an iconic movie, is there a story in here? And after I saw the film, I wrote all over social media, there is absolutely a story in here as told by filmmakers, film buffs, some people who were involved with the movie originally. Mm-hmm. My favorite being, and I got to find out how you tracked her down, the body double for Janet Leigh in the shower scene, which I'm a filmmaker and I studied film at UCLA, and we did study this film as well. I never knew Janet Leigh is like in, you know, she had one day of shooting. There's like three shots of her turning her head and screaming. And the rest of the 2 weeks was this body double in there doing the filming with Hitchcock. So tell us how you tracked her down and a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, she's actually here, by the way, in Park City, and she will be at the premiere.
Okay, so, and she's how old? Tell us. How old.
She is 78.
And she still looks gorgeous.
Oh, she's fantastic, and she has so much energy. She's
fully
wonderful.
Clothed.
Yes, she will come fully clothed. Yes. So her name is Marley Renfro, and she was 19 at the time. When she shot that, and she was a Playboy bunny.
One of the first.
Yes, one of the very first, absolutely.
Hefner's original Chicago Playboy mansion.
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. The way it worked out, because there's actually sort of this tall tale on the internet that she actually is dead. So I thought, if you actually go, I think on IMDb, you'll see that, people say she's not even alive at this point. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think about tracking her down. I assumed that she wasn't around. But I had put out a request through ACE, or the editors, to interview. Obviously, I wanted to interview a number of editors, and there's a number of them in the film. But one of them actually reached out to me and said, have you interviewed Marley Renfro? I said, well, is she around? And so he put me in touch with her, and she actually turned out to be our very, very first interview for the film. And she really set the tone for everything that we ended up, filming. And she's, our way into the story and our way out of the story. And I think in many ways, I think this film is about her.
I think so, too.
Yeah. Yeah. To what degree did you try to find out, how many of the original production crew actors of Psycho are still alive?
There's virtually nobody at this point. We had, we tracked down, I'm trying to remember, I think it was a script supervisor who was in his 80s at the time, and we had set up, we were basically 2 weeks away from having an interview with him, and then he passed away, which was really heartbreaking. But there's basically nobody left at this stage. Yeah, so,
and the film also has some further generations. You talked a little bit to Jamie Lee Curtis, who has she's not on much, but she does have a good story toward the end of the film.
Yes,
and you talked to Hitchcock's granddaughter.
Correct.
His daughter Patricia is still alive. Is that right?
She is. She's in very, very poor health, unfortunately, and so she just couldn't be interviewed. Mm. But she conferred with her daughter and so gave her. I gave my questions ahead of time so she could get the information that I needed from Patricia and give us also a really good interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what how'd you even decide, I have an idea, I'm going to do a whole film on the 52 seconds of the shower scene? I mean, what brought you to this project?
So, personally, I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. I mean, since I was 10 years old. I remember, actually, at the age of 12, I was having these quote-unquote salons with my parents and their friends, like, every week, where, because, you know, my friends were didn't care about that stuff when I was 12, you know. But, you know, I would screen like a Hitchcock film every weekend on VHS, and I would do a little introduction, and we'll have a, you know, a little Q&A afterwards. So it really started back then, you know, and I've been really studying his craft, and it's just been a passion, you know. And when I brought that to, you know, my producers, Kerry Roy and Robert Muratori, so, you know, at Exhibit A Pictures, I said, you know, I'd really love to do this. You know, they were on board, you know, thankfully.
And it wasn't a tough sale?
No, I don't think it has been a tough sale. I mean, I think, you know, it's been, you know, I've always brought these crazy ideas to them, and they've always been on board. It's really an amazing team. I mean, and this is really something I want to say, too, is the team at Exhibit A Pictures and our partners at Milk House, who did all the post-production on this. I mean, we've been working together for over a decade now. And, you know, it's, I have no words to say, you know, just how amazing these people have been in supporting that, you know, throughout the process. This has been a really difficult film to make.
Oh, I
would
imagine.
On a lot of levels, yeah.
How did you pick the people beyond those who were directly or indirectly related to the film? How did you, because there's a lot of other filmmakers and directors that give commentary on it as well. How did you pick who you, because some of them to me were an interesting choice. Some were obvious, but some were interesting choices. So what was the process of bringing these people together to comment on this film?
You know, it's really an organic process. And you know, there's obviously the obvious choices, like, you know, you have to interview a bunch of editors, clearly, because that scene was so revolutionary on so many levels. And the holy grail was Walter Murch.
Yeah.
You know, again, through an editor in Hollywood who contacted him, and, you know, we really didn't think he would respond. And one day I find an email in my inbox from Walter Murch, and I freaked out. I'm like, oh my goodness, you know? And, but he said, you know, it sounds like an interesting project. Why do you want to interview me? And so, you know,
he asked why?
He
really?
Did. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, he wanted to make sure that, you know, that I had an angle. And,
okay.
And so, you know, so I really started talking about, you know, his books that I had read, obviously, you know, that are just phenomenal, and some of his theories about film editing. And I wanted to sort of see what he had to say very specifically about the shower scene. And it was just a really magical day. I mean, we went to Bolinas to interview him in his home. And, you know, I will always remember the moment that I walked in. You know, he was sitting on his couch. The door was already open. And he had broken down the shower scene shot by shot with all the notes of the things he wanted to talk to me about, you know. It was the most prepared interview we have ever had.
Oh, okay. Now, we can probably guess a little bit through context, but for our viewers who aren't film geeks, explain who Walter Murch is.
Okay, so Walter Murch is, I think he's widely considered probably the greatest editor in the history of movies. He's won 3 Academy Awards. I mean, you're talking about Apocalypse Now, The English Patient, Talented Mr. Ripley. You can go on and on. He's you know, it's really interesting because we've interviewed also a number of Oscar-winning editors in Hollywood who all look up to Walter Murch as basically God. You know, he's like their God. And it's so it's a real treat. And he doesn't do many interviews either. Mm-hmm. So it was very special. And it was actually over 2-hour interview that we had with him. But, you know, so there were, you know, a number of other filmmakers I wanted to reach out. And, you know, there were a number of them I couldn't, you know, who were not available, who didn't want to talk to me. And that's always the process, the frustration of being a documentary filmmaker, you know. But, you know, I had to interview some genre filmmakers. Eli Roth was fantastic. Guillermo del Toro, who's also a huge Hitchcock, who actually wrote a book about Hitchcock, was just phenomenal. But I also wanted to reach out to the new generation of horror filmmakers to really discuss the impact of that scene today. I mean, here we are almost 60 years later, and that scene still has I mean, look, for my money, it is the greatest scene in the history of movies. It's the greatest 2 minutes, the most important 2 minutes in the history of movies. And I feel that even though I've been really immersed in it for 3 years, there is still so much to discover. And I don't know what's going to happen next for me on that level. I don't know if it's going to be a series of books. I don't know if it's going to be another movie. But I feel like I'm I'm just, in a way, scratching the surface now.
Yeah. And the unique thing, I think, for most film documentaries, they might find, you know, three or four talking heads. And your approach, which was interesting, was to round up these appreciators and have them talk about it from there, but have the actors talk about how Tony Perkins or Janet Leigh or the editors talk about how it affected them and directors, et cetera, et cetera. And Elijah Wood and Elijah Wood and his two buddies.
The three guys on the couch.
Spectrovision. I mean, and it's, you know, I will always remember that moment because they were, and these guys are so fantastic. They're so gracious. Elijah was shooting a movie in Las Vegas at that time, and then they were in LA, and so we organized, basically the only way that we could do the interview was going to be in Las Vegas. And so Elijah took basically his one day off to be with us, and Josh and Daniel drove from LA to meet us, which was super cool. And you know, when they walked in, they said, you know, obviously we love Hitchcock, we love Psycho, we're very interested in the shower scene, but we really don't know how much we can contribute, but let's do it, you know. And that was a 3.5-hour interview.
That was awesome. It was like a live version of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, no.
It was great.
They really added so much. And there's, you know, and again, there's so much stuff we couldn't include, you know, in the finished film that is also really so great, you know.
I don't want to give away too many of the nuggets.
Sure.
There's a lot of them.
But there is the one where they're discussing North by Northwest and the train going into the tunnel.
That's right.
Elisha, what is your... sexual? Yeah.
That's
wow.
Sex?
Yeah.
The best part was their commentary, you shooting them, watching watching footage of different things. That was great.
Well, and that you know, that's something that stylistically was very important also, is this playing on or riffing on this idea of voyeurism that obviously is key to Psycho, right? And this is why the interviewees are actually, you know, we're using the Errol Morris technique of, we have the cheap directors in Terratron where they're actually looking into the camera, you know? And you know, so we're watching them, they're watching us, they're watching Psycho. You know, the stares of Psycho are watching them as well in return. And, you know,
everybody's watching everybody.
Everybody's watching everybody. Yeah, that's the whole thing. Yeah.
Well, and there were so many great, because I've seen that movie a bunch of times and I've studied it as well. Mm. But, for example, the whole part about the piece of art that covers the peephole.
Susanna and the Elders, yeah.
Yes. Ugh. That was, I thought I knew everything about that movie, and that was all new to me. And now those things, obviously Hitchcock's gone, he's passed on, we can't confirm with him.
Yeah.
But the reasoning that he used, some of the props and some of the set design that he used, we are certain that that was intentional, correct? Or is this a happy accident?
I think when you operate at that level, I think there are always happy accidents, sure. But I really am convinced that Hitchcock operated on a level that I don't think anybody has operated on since, quite frankly. And I cannot for the life of me imagine that this was random. Because, you know, and it's not just the fact that he picked Susanna and the Elders. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that he picked this particular version by Franz van Mieris of Susanna and the Elders, which, again, we're not going to give away too much here, but it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The picture is not just about, you know, one shower scene of a couple of minutes. The thing is that you're looking to a whole bunch of different topics. Social impact, the evolution of Hitchcock, editing, camera work, and the shower scene is kind of the eye of all this hurricane.
Yes, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah.
So this is... Wouldn't you know it? They put it in the midnight show.
Yes.
So go hang out with the weirdos and the cultists.
I love the midnight show. It's actually
what I'm super favorite. Happy about it. Yeah. I like to be the only doc in the midnight section. You know. Okay. Yeah.
And you're debuting Monday at the Egyptian at shortly before midnight, and not always at midnight. Tuesday. At the Yarrow, and Thursday at in the middle of the afternoon at the Redstone Cinema, and mm-hmm. down at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. So we can candidly, unreservedly recommend this.
Oh, so, it's one of my favorite of the festival, and I've seen a lot of movies so far. So congratulations on a job well done.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alexander. 7852.
Hi, I'm Chris Greenwood, and I'm happy to support KPCW. Christopher K. Greenwood & Associates has been providing legal services to Utah residents for over 15 years now. We're located in Park City at the Gateway Center and can help with personal injury, criminal defense, divorce, child custody, alimony, and real estate matters. We can be reached at 655-3680.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Join me for the TED Radio Hour Sunday mornings at 10 right here on KPCW. Each episode takes you on a journey through the world of ideas with riveting speakers from the renowned TED stage. The show is the fastest growing program in public radio history, and it's on Sundays at 10 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you by Crandall Capital.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel with my co-host Stacy Domalski, and the film Cries from Syria. We have the director Evgeny Avanesyi, and one of the subjects of the film who's seen a lot in this documentary from the country of Syria, Khalid Helmi. Close enough. This is this will be on HBO, and tell me it's kind of a review of, it goes back in Syrian history to the 60s, but your focus is on what period?
My focus is from 2011 till our days today. The last shot was literally done last December, so technically I'm trying to recreate and document the darkest period of the Syrian history and to help to the old world to solve the Syrian refugee puzzle, to understand that they're the same people like all of us and they're only seeking shelter. But in order to tell this story, I needed to recreate and reconstruct all these 6 years of their history.
Mm-hmm. So the wonderful thing about this film is that, you know, there are people, I hate to say it, in the world who, they understand there's a problem in Syria, but they don't know specifically what that is. And what your film does is it lays it out, as Rick said, historically leading up to present day, all the backstory that has gone on and why things are happening that they are today. So my question for you is, there is a lot of personal footage from people's, I'm assuming, cell phones, or how were you able, A, to track down this footage from these people and then also convince them to let it see the light of day? Because given the story and the information you've given us, that's a very dangerous thing for some of these people to do. So how did you get people to speak out like you? You know, how did you get people to come forward and risk a lot in order to get the word out?
I think being an artist and being a filmmaker, My main goal is to tell the stories to the audience that they not have access, that they missing information and need to learn. And I think ignorance of our world coming from this darkness and not knowing this information. So when I first started to research these things, I found out a lot of fascinating information that I not was even aware of that. And being already a filmmaker coming out of Winter on Fire that was last year nominated for Oscar, that also told the history. I came, I started to research, I met people, people introduced me to more people. It's a process, it's a long process of over 2 years. So people saw that I'm able to deliver voices like I delivered voices from Ukraine, and I wanted to deliver their voices. And you know what I learned for them? Cameras, cell phones, it's their weapon. It's from the beginning of the revolution, and you will hear it from the Hollywood right now. It was their weapon to show to the world. But unfortunately, their voices were only in Syria. They tried to break the borders, but they not had this choice. So I tried to give them this chance to take their voices and bring to the entire world, so the entire world can learn their story, understand this puzzle of Syrian refugees that we see in these days, and to understand in all depths of this puzzle.
So Khalid, so when he came forward and you met, and being a woman in a very patriarchal society, how did you at first when you met, did you think about that, and at what point did you say, I'm in?
I didn't hesitate because I am an activist, and I started in 2011, and I know that it's dangerous. And when I was in Damascus, I was reporting from Damascus, and I know that it's a very high price that I have to pay, but we have to tell the story out. We've been working since 2011 to let everybody knows that we are there for a dream or a call for freedom from the very beginning. But then things shifted dramatically because everybody interfered. And I don't know, maybe we were not, because we were living the events, we were not awake, if I may use this word, to make the story as Evgeny had the chance to, because he is not an outsider. I can't call him an outsider. He's more Syrian than me after the movie. But I mean, because he is from outside, he could have this overlook, and then he can make things in this historical way that he could tell the story. And people were ready to speak out because they were really oppressed and they want everybody to know. We all know, but the international community doesn't know.
They don't know to the degree of which this film makes you aware.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's heard of, the problem in Syria.
Yeah.
But I don't think people realize what it is and to what degree. So do you live in Syria?
Recently, no.
Yeah. I would imagine it would be hard for you to go back anytime soon.
I can't go. I couldn't go back to Syria since 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I was pursued by the regime, and then the regime arrested my friends, and we have to flee. We left the country then, and now I can't go back to Syria.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
We should mention that you proceed the film clearly saying that there are some disturbing graphic images in here, and there definitely are. So it's in many ways it's a tough film to watch, and I don't know for you guys, it's excruciating to keep looking at these images while you're working on it or editing it or what. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know what, it's important that the world will see what these people went through, and people understand that we here, as much as we have different troubles in our society, we taking sometimes things for granted, and we need to be more compassionate, we need to more understanding, we need to be more respecting, and not taking some things for granted, because you know what, we taking things like freedom of speech. Right now it's kind of a tricky situation, but you know what, still, we have our freedom of speech here, and they were fighting for that. We have our human rights. They don't. And I think it's crucial to show to our audience, even its disturbing images, the truth that was there, the truth through what these people went through, so our audience can understand why these people seeking shelter. They're not coming to take over our land, but they seeking shelter. And trust me, they do want to go back home, because, for example, for her, her home is not exist anymore. She was living in a suburb of Damascus that called Darea, that completely destroyed right now, and nobody living there. So, for example, her home is not exist anymore. And for her, her dream is still go home. For most of the people whom I interviewed, their dream is to go home. And a lot of people, even they moved from Syria to as a refugees to Jordan or to some other countries, they slowly, slowly going back because there is no home like home. It's her phrase from yesterday. She was talking about that and she said, there is no home like home. We all want to go back home.
Okay, I know it's a politically, it's more complicated than a soundbite. But I think what a lot of people, especially in Western countries, United States, Canada, you know, what they don't understand is why the government attacks their own people. Why? So, you know, I know you can't oversimplify it, but can you give us a little bit about what's, and you talk about it in the film. I've seen the film, but for listeners to understand why there isn't even a problem, can you tell us what is the point of attack of a government attacking their own citizens?
I think it's more question to her because what I'm doing in the movie, I'm voicing their voices. Okay. So I think it's more question to Hulud.
I think they were so afraid of the change that was proposed to come. And I think at that time, the government has nothing to do but to kill the people, to silence them up, to shut them up.
Progress. They did not want to see progress.
No, because for 60 years, we've been under the same government. And imagine that the one family ruling the whole country threatened for, I mean, it was like faced by the change to come, and they didn't accept that. Mm-hmm. So they started the killing. To be very frank with you, I expected them to be fierce because we know incidents from the past, but not that fierce. Mm-hmm. Like in 1980s, they attacked two provinces. And they killed people. They killed over 40,000 people in 1982.
And this is women and children, not just
everything,
men, everything in sight.
And after that, they started under the accusation of that they are Muslim Brotherhood, which was a political party. So afterwards, everyone who is against the government or the government wants to put him or her in jail, he is Muslim Brotherhoods, even if he is or she is Christian. We have many Christians in prison for a long, long time under the pretext that they are Muslim Brotherhood. So we know that this regime is so fierce, but he killed people but not destroyed the country in 1982. Mm-hmm. Now the sun destroyed the country. And I think that they were really terrified by the movement of change and the voices of people. Imagine that in one of the demonstrations, 500,000 people were demonstrating. So they silenced them all.
Hmm. Unbelievable.
Cries from Syria will make its debut at the festival just this afternoon, 2:30 over at the Mark. And on Tuesday, Tuesday evening at the Library Center Theater. The Redstone Cinema on next Friday night. So, Evgeny and Talud, thank you for making the movie and thank you for being here.
And I think the general audience out of Sundance can see it on the 13th of March. That will be the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the revolution. Mm. The general population of the United States, the audience, will be able to see it at HBO starting from the 13th of March.
Okay, so March 13th. Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, ESCO.
There we go. Welcome again to our final interview for the Sundance Reel for Sunday morning with my co-host, Stacy Domalski, and we're wrapping up with a film from the United Kingdom called God's Own Country. We get to triple hitter here with the director, Francis Lee. Hello, Francis.
Hi.
And the stars, Josh O'Connor.
Hi.
Hello. And Alex Sekaranu.
Yes, that's correct.
Didn't massacre
Hello,
that.
Hello, America.
Didn't massacre that too much. this is a story in the set in Yorkshire, England, and this is a line you don't see too often in the Sundance program. It says, "You can smell the mud in this movie." So, Francis, lay it out for us here. What's our story?
Well, the film is set in Yorkshire on the Pennines, which is a small mountain ridge down the centre of the country in the north. And it's about Johnny Sexby, who's a sheep farmer, trying to keep his family's sheep farm going on his own because his dad's had a stroke and his grandma's too old. And all his friends have left to go to university or towns where they've got jobs. And so he's very geographically and socially isolated and very angry about it and very emotionally cut off. And it comes to lambing time when all the lambs are born. And he can't do all the work on his own, so his dad employs a Romanian migrant worker to come and help him, who's working his way around the country. And the two boys, to begin with, don't get on. They're very antagonistic towards each other. And they're sent off to do the lambing up on the hills. And a begrudging respect grows between them as they both realize that they are both very much of the farming world. And out of this comes a very strong physical, sexual relationship that then turns into an emotional relationship. And the story becomes about whether or not Johnny can open himself up emotionally enough to be loved and to love.
Mm. So the word sexual, I guess, is there a little bit of Brokeback in this?
I think it's an interesting comparison. I think that the difference within this film is that the sexuality isn't an issue, that there isn't any kind of homophobia from his family or from the local community. It's much more of an emotional story of a boy who's having to open up to find first love.
Well, you fellas, talk a little bit about how you came to these roles and just looking at you here, looks like the chemistry is pretty easy. So yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
We had a chemistry test before Francis cast us both. And we prepared for 2 weeks before we started shooting. And we had to work in farms to be able to control better the animal work that we had to do in the film. And we learned how to lamb, how to give injections to animals, how to, cut their hooves. And every single day we basically worked as farmers. And of course, in these 2 weeks, we had also some rehearsals to develop our parts and our story.
Yeah, I think the way Francis works and worked on this film immediately was kind of worked with the way Alec and I work as well. So we kind of went into minute detail in the character. So we made notes and kind of choices about how these characters moved and looked. And and their backgrounds, it to such detail that it kind of, hopefully it comes out in the performance.
I think it does.
Yeah. Well, Josh and Alec, what are your particular backgrounds? I mean, is it a big leap to get into, sheep farming in Yorkshire?
basically, yeah. Big leap. I grew up in the countryside, so I've seen a lot of sheep, but I've never sort of experienced what we experienced in this film. It was, I had to kind of start from the beginning, really, and which is an amazing experience. And we had, I worked with this farmer called John, who was become a very good friend of mine and was brilliantly helpful in kind of seeing that world and experiencing that world. but yeah, no experience of that at all.
And now,
oh, go ahead. I'm just wondering, so the theme or the story of this is, it sounds like isolation, but you learn that you cannot go it alone in this world.
Exactly.
So how, what was the, where did the story come from for you? Where did, how did this, how did you get the idea for this, and then how did you develop it?
Well, my dad is a sheep farmer in Yorkshire. Okay. I grew up there, and I left Yorkshire when I was 20 to go to London and train as an actor. But for all that time I was in London and working as an actor, I could never get that landscape out of my head. It felt so ingrained in every part of me. And it started to feel like I needed to explore what might have happened if I had never left. And if I'd have stayed, if I'd have worked there, and if I'd have met somebody there I liked, how that might have played out.
Yeah. Well, your story, it's kind of a common theme that comes up in kind of UK culture, this idea of the person, the blue collar or the rural person looking beyond to a more urbane or artistic kind of life. And
me personally, you mean?
Yeah.
I think that for me personally, I grew up in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s in Yorkshire, and it was a very different place then. And I knew that I had to leave to find what I wanted to do, who I wanted to be. The opportunities weren't there then. And so this is a contemporary tale, and I wanted to look at it, what it would be like now, and how different it is now.
Are your parents still alive?
Yeah.
Have they seen this film?
No.
Oh.
But they will. They will. Dad, so we shot the film 10 minutes away from Dad's farm, and Dad was very present. He supplied a lot of the animals. He supplied a lot of the technique. The boys lived on my dad's farm during the rehearsal and during the shoot, so they had ready access to information that Dad was providing. No, I think my parents will really, I think they'll really like it. I think they'll enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I think it was very important that I got the authenticity absolutely right as far as the farming's concerned. Otherwise, my dad would be very angry.
So your actors stayed in the place that you grew up? Did you grow up on that place?
I didn't grow up in that particular farm, okay. But they've lived there for 25 years, so it is home for me. Mm-hmm. And I moved back to Yorkshire to make the film, and I've never left. I now live there.
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
I
live on a hill in a wooden hut, so on the moors. So everything about this film feels very ingrained. So the sound of the wind, the birds, the light, the mud.
It's the mud.
The mud. It's all you.
It's all me.
Yeah. Okay. Well,